Excision number 23221, Reel 4.
Major Mole, Reel 4.
You were saying that you were asked to decide whether a village should evacuate or should remain in place. Can you remember what you advised them to do?
I had this very nice corporal with me, and I think we sort of said to the headman, and the whole village was there, would you just excuse us for a moment? And we walked off, and I said, what on earth do we do? And I think we felt that perhaps the wisest thing for them to do was to stay, because the general, I think as I said earlier, perhaps the general feeling was that we wanted to keep refugees off the road and we didn't want villagers coming down, and they couldn't really see there was very much point in it. And so I think we suggested that they stayed. And as it so happened, that village, I think, came quite close to where the sort of line between, later on, between the Chinese and the British was. So it must have been a very nasty place for them to have remained in. But at the time, I think that was the advice we gave. And it was quite a responsibility, really, for somebody who was 20 or something to say to a whole village, you know, stay. But I think it was probably the right advice at the time.
Do you remember any other incident on that particular jeep patrol? Did you come across any signs of enemy or...
No, I don't think so. No, I think we were a bit jumpy. Sort of not quite sure what the situation was, because it was very fluid at that time. And there were a lot of people sort of beginning to flee, as it were, these terrible scenes of the refugees in great quantities.
You were south of Seoul after the retirement from Happy Valley and then further on through the capital beyond. You were saying that General Ridgway made a tremendous difference when he arrived. What signs of that difference were there to you as a...
Well, I think really basically speaking at that time, the sort of morale was pretty low. Mm. I don't mean necessarily regimental morale, but the whole sort of seemed to be the sort of atmosphere bugging out and getting back towards Busan, etc. And I think there was a sort of general feeling that, you know, the Chinese were sort of around us all everywhere. But I think Ridgway made it totally and absolutely clear that there was going to be no withdrawals of any sort whatsoever from that line, and the Americans, the British, nobody else was going to withdraw, so there was no use considering the next line of withdrawal. It was definitely, that's where we were, and we were going forward after. And I think that actually was quite a good, psychologically quite a good thing.
Did anyone that you knew know anything about Ridgway and his background?
Absolutely not, no. No, we didn't really know anything about him.
You mentioned that you saw Brigadier Brodie, the brigade commander. What about the divisional commander? Did he make himself known and appear amongst you?
We didn't really have a divisional commander at that time because the brigade was an independent brigade at that stage under the Americans, but we never saw the... I don't ever remember seeing an American divisional commander. It was only later when the Commonwealth Division started, when Castles came, that there was... but I never really was... We were more or less leaving by that time.
You're saying that you had to learn on the job, as it were, a second-in-command of the mortar platoon. What was the role, the primary role of the mortars within the battalion?
Well, we had... We had in support also the 4.2-inch mortars, which were, you know, as you understand, were Royal Artillery, but the 3-inch mortars were really, I suppose, the first line of defence of the battalion's own artillery to a certain extent. And the mortars were useful in being able to have DFSOSs on the forward company positions. And really the role of the, as me as 2IC or the sergeant was to act as mortar fire controllers or MFCs like the FOOs for the Royal Artillery and to be attached to the forward companies. That's really basically what it was.
What was the range, how far out could they reach?
You should know that. I can't remember, but they, would it be 3,000 yards? I can't. I really can't remember. I should know, but I can't remember.
Do you have any idea of what sort of response time you could achieve if you were called on to provide a DF?
I think it was because the mortars would be laid on the DFSOS positions for each, and I think the response time could be, I mean, a matter of a minute or so. It could be very quick.
And how did you correct the fire? Was it simply by spotting the fall of the bomb?
Yes. But the extraordinary thing was, although I was second in command, I had had no mortar training. So I was very much learning as I went along, really under Alan Hill, who was commanding the mortar platoon, and under the mortar platoon sergeants, who were excellent. But it wasn't extraordinary. It wasn't particularly complicated, as long as one knew how to range them and that sort of thing.
How long do you think it took you then to pick it up and become au fait with what you needed to know?
Well, that's a bit of a blur, really. My actually leaving a platoon, and a rifle platoon, and becoming second in command of the mortars, being involved with the mortars, is a bit of a blur to me.
What sort of location did you look for to emplace them? What were the characteristics of a good position for the battalion mortars?
Well, the mortars needed to be tucked away behind a hill, if possible, in a fairly sort of sheltered valley, as it were, so because the great advantage of the mortars, of course, is they can fire over hills, etc., so they can be really wanted to tuck them away pretty well behind the hills, and usually fairly close in towards TAC headquarters or something like that. Of course, they had to be defended. You couldn't have them just out by themselves.
Who would actually defend them? Would that be rifle platoon?
Well, it would probably be close to the rear company in a defensive position. I really can't remember.
When you were on mortar fire control, were you in touch with them by line or by wireless normally?
I think we were in touch by wireless. Sometimes, I suppose, if it was, it would have been by line, but basically wireless. Certainly, as the thing got more fluid later on, etc., there was no time to lay line.
You mentioned the 4.2-inch mortars being manned by the Royal Artillery. Were they a brigade unit, or were they assigned to battalion?
They were brigade, but I think sometimes you had a section of 4.2-inch mortars also attached, more or less attached to the... But I think, if I remember rightly, they were more inclined to... Because their range was slightly further, they were inclined to work as a separate what were they? A battery. I think they were just an independent battery of 4.2-inch mortars. I think they stayed together, basically, as a battery.
So presumably they had their own mortar fire control with them.
Yeah.
Mm. Were you able to mass fire with them, if necessary, to put down a really heavy DF?
I suppose we were in that position, yes. But I think we more or less made our own. The more DFs you could have, their DFs and ours. But I suppose in some cases it's quite likely that the DFSOS in some cases could have been mutual.
What happened then next? You said you were south of Seoul, and you were, there. What happened after that?
That's why I was trying to look in the book. I can't really. It was a sort of period. We didn't have any contact with the enemy. We had sort of gone back a long way. My basic memory, really, of that time was of extreme cold. It was very, very cold. And it was a sort of twilight, a sort of odd period when nothing was happening very much, because we had put a considerable distance between us and the Chinese, and so it was just a question of waiting. We were, I suppose, really in a sort of reserve position back there.
Could you do anything to mitigate the effects of the cold?
Well, we weren't allowed to go in. It was quite categorically clear that we weren't allowed to go in the houses. So it was a firm think that we must be out and not in. I think, because I think one or two people, I think that some of the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers had been caught in houses at Jane just prior to the Battle of the Imjum, and it was felt that it was much better to be out in the open. I think we went in from time to time just to sort of warm up and light a fire on. But basically speaking, there was nobody in those villages then anyway. No, we just had to stay out.
What about your clothing? Were you able to?
Well, then this sort of the cold weather clothing, I think, had come up by then, but it wasn't particularly effective.
What did it consist of?
Well, it had there was a sort of different type of boot, if I remember. And I really can't remember much about it, except it was slightly more effective.
Presumably you were getting replacements for your battle casualties at this stage when you were in reserve.
Yes.
Remember them turning up.
Yes. Mm. Again, I'm afraid my memory's hazy of that.
Do you remember whether or not the mortar section got any, or mortar platoon got any?
Well, I don't think the mortar platoon had actually suffered much in the way of casualties, because they hadn't been actually affected by the Imjum battle, I don't think particularly, because they had been, as you say, was a bit behind, so they hadn't, and I don't remember anything specifically of that.
Do you know if these replacements were actual recalled reservists, or whether they were mostly national servicemen who come out?
I think they were a mixture of both national servicemen and reservists. Who, I think they all came from Kure in Japan, from the camp in Kure.
Did they have any difficulty in settling in or being accepted?
No, I don't think so. Probably people were delighted to see some more people. I didn't. It's not a specific memory.
Do you have any notion of how long you were there then in reserve?
Not really. No, not really at that time.
What was the next event that you do remember then after that period?
Well, the next thing really I remember really is when we moved up to the line of the Imjum. And the Royal Ulster Rifle were placed forward of the Imjum initially in the position later occupied by the Belgian battalion. And we dug in. I can remember the battalion digging in various in fairly strong positions. This was a rather odd position, the battalion being the only battalion north of the Imjum, with the Gloucesters and Northumberland Fusiliers behind us. And I can remember specifically being the mortar position there in the valley, inside the box, as it were, of the Royal Ulster Rifle battalion position forward of the river. And that period lasted some weeks, I think, and that was a sort of extraordinary period when, again, there was no contact with the Chinese, and the battalion was involved in very long forward sweeps up to 15,000 yards forward, trying to see what was happening. And there was no sign of the enemy at that time, which was weird. And it was a sort of interim period. We didn't know whether we were going to go forward or whether we were going to go back or whether we were going to defend or what. And the Chinese were really very clever concealing their intentions.
You say you're in a box position. What were the rough dimensions of the box? Do you have any notion of that?
Not really. I can't. It was quite a good position. It was quite close compared to later on things like the Gloucesters and etc. The Gloucesters' position was, and the Northumberland Fusiliers were quite spread out, but the that Ulster Rifle, the Belgian position, was really quite a close position, quite a good, strong position. I remember one night we went down to some party, and the Belgians were in reserve. We went to this party with the Belgians, and there was an extremely distinguished Belgian officer who'd got a DSO and something during the war, and he was commanding one of the companies of the Belgian battalion, and he was quite a character. He had a rather splendid party. And when we went back up onto our positions after this in the evening, he decided he would mortar us. So because he'd fairly well away, and he mortared us with smoke bombs, which was quite entertaining. But then we moved back from then. Can't remember exactly how long we were there, but the battalion swapped with the Belgians. The Belgians took over our position, and we moved back into Brigade Reserve. This is all prior to the start of the Battle of the Imjin.
You said it was quite a good position. What was the ground like on the box position north of the Imjin?
Well, it was very hilly, and you had the river behind you, some quarter of a mile behind you, I think. And it was really like all that position around there. It was sort of the actual battalion position was fairly low hills relative to the big hills like the Kamaksan and the other hills behind us. But it was a good position.
Did you have mines and wire to strengthen?
Yes, it was. I think we did have quite a good, strong position of wire and mines around there.
What was your line of communication back like across the river?
Well, it was something called the Ulster Crossing, which you could. It was a ford. There's a photograph, a famous photograph of you crossing the 49th parallel by the courtesy of the Royal Ulster Rifles. Could that have been there? No, I think that was somewhere else. But anyway, there was a thing known as the Ulster Crossing, where you could go across in, at that particular time of the year, Oxford carriers could go through the river at that time. And there were one or two well-known fords.
Did you go forward on any of those reconnaissance?
Yes, we did. The whole company, sort of company sweeps with tanks, etc. And you just didn't see anything.
Were they effectively in the form of an advance to contact?
Yes, I suppose they were really, but there was no contact because we didn't.
Couldn't bump anything?
No.
Who supplied you with the tanks?
Well, that would have been 8th Hussars who were in the brigade.
How would you actually be deployed with the tanks when you were moving up with them in support? What sort of formation would you adopt? Would you ride on the tanks or would you?
Oh, absolutely not. No, I mean, the tanks would go forward and then we'd go forward and the tanks would go forward a bit, but it was sort of, it's all a bit fairy tale because there wasn't any contact. And but I suppose it was a sort of logical way of doing it. They would go up to a bit of high ground and then we'd go forward, etc.
So it's leapfrogging.
Yeah. Yeah.
And did you have any arrangements for artillery support if you did happen to come in?
Oh, yes. The MFCs were with us. And but we simply didn't make contact.
Sounds rather like a company group exercise with extreme apprehension.
Yes, that's really what it was.
Do you think that the presence of the tanks gave your soldiers more confidence?
Oh, I think so, yes. I think it's quite nice to have these great Centurion tanks belting around. And the fact that later on they were a cause of a lot of the wounded when you get on them and go out on them, etc., is a separate issue. But
what were the Belgians like? You mentioned that they had an officer with a sense of humour commanding one of the companies. What was your overall impression of the Belgian battalion?
Well, I don't really think we saw much of them. It's ironic that I then went to the Belgian Staff College many years later. But no, I think they seem a fine lot of chaps, quite experienced and very keen, and they were attached to the brigade and very fine. And subsequently, they did only well because when they managed to get out of that position without suffering casualties at all, hardly.
When you went back and occupied the positions they'd been in as brigade reserve, what were they like? Were they the same sort of positions as you would have?
No, they weren't really dug-in positions very much. They were just sort of waiting to see. It wasn't really a dug-in position at all. It was.
What happened next then? So you've been up to the Imjin, you've been north of it, done your reconnaissance.
Well, I suppose the next thing that happened really was basically both Alan Hill was a platoon commander, a mortar platoon commander, went on leave, and the colonel, Colonel Carson, who was commanding the Royal Ulster Rifles, known as Hank Carson, both all went on leave, which gives you an indication that this was the R&R sort of leave which went on a cycle. It wasn't considered a time of considerable worry, because the CO wouldn't have gone if he thought it was imminent battle. So the battalion was commanded by somebody called Gerald Rickard, who was a very experienced chap, and Alan Hill had gone now as commanding the mortars. And really the next thing that happened was the start of the Chinese started to come down, and they attacked the forward company of the Gloucesters, they attacked the forward company of the Royal Northumberlands, who had a patrol out at the Ulster Crossing, a platoon down there, and they seemed to avoid the Belgian battalion, and increasingly the thing started. And
what was the first you knew of it then?
Well, the first we knew of it was that these reports of very heavy fighting, both in the Gloucester's forward positions and the Northumberland positions, and I think the battalion was stood to, and all, and we went forward to behind the Northumberland Fusilier positions. I was with the acting CO, and I think it was pretty confusing as to where exactly we were to go, because it was very fluid at that time and nobody really knew what was happening. The battle patrol went forward. We had this battle patrol which went forward in the Oxford carriers towards Ulster Crossing to try and help that company, and that was virtually ambushed, and a lot of people were killed in that ambush.
Were your mortars in a position to give any fire support to the two forward battalions?
No, because they were a long way away.
Too far back.
They were it was never the role of battalion mortars to help other battalions at that time, and we went. The distances were far too great. The Gloucesters were a long way off, the Northumberlands a long way off, etc., and we had no idea what the position was, what was happening.
Was there a brigade plan of any sort to respond to an attack that you were aware of?
Well, in hindsight, I really don't know, but the big problem, I suppose, of the whole Battle of the Imjim was that the brigade was dispersed on too wide a front. The Gloucesters were sort of a long way away on the western side, and there was a big gap between the Gloucesters and Northumberland Fusiliers, and then there was the Belgian battalion and us in reserve, but it was very widely dispersed, and I don't suppose that the brigade commander had any choice. He was probably told to cover that area, and the Imjim was considered to be, like in many military things, that it was a natural barrier, but in fact it didn't turn out to be much of a barrier, because as I said, there were forwards in it. And
the Belgians were in the forward position north of the Imjim, and they were more or less left alone, you were saying?
They seemed to be left alone, and subsequently they withdrew to the east. Mm. Not quite sure how, because we never had any plan any of that nature, but they managed to get across the east and join the Americans east, where presumably when they were ordered to move out, but they didn't seem to, as far as I know, be involved in any fierce fighting.
So you were saying earlier on that one of the Chinese techniques was to get in behind strong positions rather than attack them directly if they could, and it sounds as though they were...
Well, they had come through between the Gloucesters and the Northumberlands, and as I say, there was this very large gap between the Northumberlands and Gloucesters, and they had already started getting up onto this very high feature known as Cumac Sun, and also even to behind that to sort of area of the I think it's 45 Field Regiment who are supporting. I think it's 45 Field Regiment where the 25 pounders were. Some of them were being fired at. So they had infiltrated people right the way back.
Had they got as far back as your positions?
Well, they must have been behind us because we were the brigade. The guns were much behind us.
So the back.
Yes. Yeah,
so they hadn't made any direct attack.
No, not on us at that stage. Now we're getting towards the morning of the 23rd of April, and I do remember specifically that we were sort of in the valley on the road behind the Northumberland Fusiliers, and I remember seeing the CO and some of the officers of the Northumberland Fusiliers having an O group, and they were all had the rose in their hats that day because it was St George's Day. I remember that particularly as a memory.
What did your 2IC want to do? He was in charge of the battalion, wasn't he?
He was eventually ordered to move up. He was ordered to move up to this, to leave, to put B Company back where the battalion had been on the ridge behind, and to put most of the battalion up on point 395, 398, which was on the right of the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers.
So this is effectively extending the brigade front a little to the right.
Well, yes, extending behind the where the Belgians had been, and it was a high ground. So if you had come up some there, you had this high ridge up there, and so D Company and A Company attack headquarters were put there, and C Company were put back on the position. I can't remember where the other company was. A and D. I don't know where the other company was.
What about your mortars? Were they?
Well, the mortars were back with B Company, in that area there.
It's the morning of the 23rd of April, and did you manage to make these redeployments unmolested?
Yes, unmolested, virtually. And we got up to the top, and then I think as A Company moved forward along the spur of that position, and this is where the Gordon Potts account of A Company is much more clear. Until I read that account recently, I really wasn't clear as to what happened. But that company, which was slightly forward of TAC headquarters and D Company, then did come into contact with a few scattered groups of Chinese, but nothing very severe. And we all started to dig in, D Company, A Company in town headquarters on this sort of ridgeline.
What could you see looking forward from that ridgeline when the light came up?
Well, you could see really not very much because it was very wooded. I think you could see the river, the bend in the river possibly. And I can remember some fairly heavy DFSOS fire being put in, and if I remember rightly, some airstrikes going in, and also firing the mortars very heavily in into the sort of valleys beneath us, where it was suspected the Chinese were beginning to build up.
Was this then speculative fire that you were putting down?
Yes, at that time.
You were looking for potential FUPs.
Yeah.
Did you see any signs that you were having an impact?
Not really, not at that stage.
It's just likely places where they might be.
Yeah, a little bit. And I suppose we were sort of sounding out. I mean, we weren't firing a lot, but we were sort of presumably checking on where our DFSOSs would go. And
who was making this plan then? Was this the second in command making the plan as you were going along?
Well, the mortars, well, I was left more or less to do what I wanted with the mortars, but the plan, the whole battalion, was where the battalion was going to be, etc., was sort of forced by circumstance and brigade headquarters.
So brigade headquarters told the battalion where to go.